This is 94.7 WPVC Resistance Radio, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. Welcome to Apropos of Something, airing every Saturday morning from 10 to 11, co-hosted by me, Ellen Daniels, in our Charlottesville studio, and Nancy Lawrence from our satellite in New York. We seek out the most interesting people we can find with a passion for social justice, political activism, and the arts, and we guarantee every show will be apropos of something. We are very grateful for the sponsorship of the Beckham team at Keller Williams Realty. Today, we have a great show. We are speaking with Tanisha Hudson, activist born and raised in Charlottesville. And we welcome back Grace Hale, professor of history and American studies at the University of Virginia. Her book is Making Whiteness. We'll discuss race and the South. We had so much to talk about last month when she was here. We had scheduled her pretty immediately for her to return. So we welcome her back to the show. If you have questions for our guests during the show, message us on the station Facebook page at 947WPVC. If you know me, you can text me. We'll take your questions. Check out all our podcasts. All 22 shows are on the station website, 947.org. Nancy, are you there in New York City?
I'm in the satellite, Ellen. I am above New York has a new satellite smell. In fact, thank you for sending the funding for the satellite. Yes, I am here.
Well, I have to say it was great to see you. I saw you in person last weekend. It was great to hang out with you.
I have no memory of this. No. Okay.
Yeah. It's great to see you. I think there's a difference I noticed. People are, of course, feeling things a little differently there. And it was really nice to be in a place that was incredibly diverse, in my opinion. It was great to be there. So
if I pay for the coffee, you'd be even more effusive. But I'll take it. Yeah. That was great seeing you as well.
Yeah. I ate my way through that city as usual and saw some really good friends. So that was great, including you.
Yes, so I know. I made the list. I know. You were just checking out the satellite. You were afraid I took it all and used it on, I don't know, a Kohl's shopping spree or something. But no, I
Kohl's
invested there? For. No, I don't know.
Well, this is our first show since 8/12, August 12th. Orange Hitler has definitely continued to usher in the dark ages all over again. But I wanted to say, and we are going to talk about that, of course, today. But on a positive note, last night I went to Congregation Beth Israel. They are the synagogue in town, and they were assaulted by white supremacists taunting congregants on that Saturday 2 weeks ago. The members of the synagogue had to go out the back door. It was pretty horrible. So this Shabbat, I will say the Sabbath, Friday night, this singer and a bunch of musicians from all over the country actually decided they needed to be there. And it was this wonderful celebration. The singer Julie Silver came, and it was really great. So that was healing.
I love that you start the show on a bright spot. That's very impressive. And that's the thing about the rest of us, we seem to care about each other, and but as you aptly called him, Orange Hitler has other designs on the country. He's like a Category 4 storm. It's not just in Texas. It's in the White House, that guy. He's a constant.
For sure.
Category. Yes. Anyway, that sounds...
There's another... there's a slew of resignations, of course, and recently, and... The list goes on and on, Gorka, among many others. But there's this guy who resigned, he's gone under the radar, director of Rapid Response. This guy was in charge of getting the media to talk favorably about the administration, but also literally putting folders twice a day on Blotus's desk of positive news stories about him.
Oh, the propaganda folders. Right.
Exactly.
No, I didn't realize he already... Anyway, you were saying, please.
No, the guy resigned. Andy Hemming, he was one of many. I could go on. But
right.
Another guy, Daniel Kamen, resigned. Do you know about that guy? Sounds like
the science envoy.
Exactly.
Yes. Right, yeah.
Yes, it's becoming a thing now in your resignation letter to put secret messages that aren't so secret.
Right.
His was
right, like
impeached.
The Arts and Humanities Committee.
Right.
The ones that spelled out resist, I think.
Yes, they did. And he spelled out impeach. And his line was, your presence, or one of his lines, your presence in the White House harms the U.S. domestically and abroad and threatens life on the planet.
Yeah, I remember him putting his hand on the Bible and promising to do all that. So I don't know what Mr. Kamen's problem is. Everyone except the GOP in Congress. A lot of resignations. Business boards, the Manufacturing Council, and the Strategic and Policy Forum member last week. They both, and then of course Trump said, "No, I'm breaking up with you first." But you know, those advisory councils have left, and it continues to be an abandoned ship, but not where it really seems to matter, which is in Congress, at least in my opinion.
Yes, and just because. There's so much to talk about. I wanted to get to some of the events coming up in our town. So today at noon, Stand Up for Charlottesville at the Free Speech Wall is the event held by Indivisible to demand. I mean, it feels fruitless, but I think it's great to show support. I think it does matter, or to show resistance for Congressman Garrett to turn his words into action, fighting white supremacy in Washington. So that's noon here in Charlottesville, noon to one. The Free Speech Wall. Jefferson School African American Heritage Center continues to have amazing programming. There's something tomorrow, 2 to 4. Can you elaborate a little bit more on that one?
The film is called Whose Streets? And it is a look at an unflinching, you know, a really serious look at the Ferguson uprising, and it's told by activists and leaders who lived and breathed the movement for justice.
Right.
It sounds amazing.
And it's free. There's a donation if you care to give for $5. Again, that's tomorrow, Sunday, August 27th. Whose Streets? Jefferson School African American Heritage Center. It's told by the activists and leaders who, like you said, lived that. That's a film. And then they have a series called Reading the Black Intellectual Series on Saturdays. September 16th, Angela Davis, an autobiography they're going to be talking about. And October 14th, Women, Race, and Class. November 18th, Freedom is a Constant Struggle. For people who listen to the podcast later, I was actually told that might be helpful to give some events out into the future. So we have an amazing show today. I'm really looking forward to talking to our first guest and our second guest, Grace Hale. But our first guest, Tanisha Hudson, she is an activist who has lived in Charlottesville her entire life. We want to welcome her to the program. She has been, you may have seen her at the end of the Vice video. She's also been very vocal in lots of arenas here, lots of venues, lots of interviews. So we welcome Tanisha. Welcome.
Thank you for having me. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. That's a good idea. Yes. Good morning. Let's try that too. Yes.
So, let's start with describing where you were August 12th in Charlottesville, what you saw, and what you were experiencing.
So, August 12th, I was in the heart of the rally. Before it was like just the clergy group. I was standing with the clergy group. Seth and I went to high school together. And so Seth Whispleway and I were, we were locked armed and being positive because we knew, I knew along with the city, we knew that this one was going to be worse than July 8th. Why the city fails to admit that this one was going to be worse, it doesn't surprise me, but it shocks me that the city ignored the fact that this was going to be the worst one. So we were standing on the edge of Market. Literally, our toes were touching the sidewalk facing Emancipation Park. And we were singing, I'm going to say spirituals, not really hymns, but just positive music, positive gospel. And just trying to give a better, I think we were trying to set a better tone for what was to come. I think that was the purpose of the clergy group, was to set a better tone for what was about to happen. And as we were doing that, now mind you, none of the white nationalists, none of the Unite the Rights, none of them had really arrived at this point, because we got there pretty early, about 8-ish. And so this one guy that was part of them, I guess he runs I'm not sure if it's a podcast or a radio show, but he kept coming by kind of like nitpicking and asking people, do you know what John 3:16 mean? Do you know what Psalms 45 stand for? And he was basically nitpicking these pastors or anybody that was standing beside them. So in my mind, the thoughts were already running through my mind, like, if you are mocking religion or a pastor or asking a pastor, like, well, what's your sexuality? You knew that this day was going, I knew this day was going to be bad from the time this guy approached to the time they started walking by, to the time they started taking their flagpoles and tilting it to wave in front of people's face to hit them in the top of the head. You knew that it was already going to be some type of turmoil that happens. And so after about the second group, I go up to Detective Mooney, because I grew up in Hardy Drive, so I'm familiar with all types of cops. So I go up to Detective Mooney and I say, now you guys are allowing them, we're in the street and they're walking on the sidewalk purposely to be disrespectful to us. And we have a right to counter protest just like they have a right to protest. And we file permits to be here, but you guys aren't allotting us any protections. And they can basically do what they want with these flags, with these flagpoles. And you're in a position you can't even see the nitpicking happening. And I was told, if anything was to happen, we'll react. But until then, we're going to stay right here. Mm-hmm. At that point, I knew that it was just it was just going to be a dangerous situation, because they were allowing them to disrespect the people of Charlottesville. And at that point, that's when I immediately started going on Facebook and writing, our police ain't nothing. They don't care about us. They're not here to protect us. The people of this city are being disrespected. We pay our taxes and we are allotted no protections. Now, the police, who's supposed to represent the law, are the ones that should offer equal protections to all parties, right? We're talking about a protest. So I'm going to give you guys a visual. I want you to go back to the 60s when they were protesting. They were always standing in front of black people before the civil rights movement. They were always in between both parties during the civil rights movement. But here we are in 2017, and you have the police standing right in front of the Unite the Right. And for a long time, we've had the analogy that the police really don't care. But I think I actually finally seen it physically, that they don't care. And it has nothing to do with black and white at this point, because it was clearly more black people, white people out there than black people. It's way more white people. But again, we're talking about white people who are freedom riders at this point. So at that moment, all the white people out there were looked at just how black people is looked at every day by the police. They don't care. They didn't care. And so at that point, I think my main focus was, I'm going to do whatever I can to expose the state police, the city police, and anybody else that was out there that's supposed to have been allotting equal protections, because they failed this city. They may not want to take responsibility for it. They may not want to, speak on it. You can't even get them to say nothing about it. You know, it's like, and each entity of the government wants to protect the next. All these council candidates want to protect. I want to thank the police for what? A young lady didn't make it home to her mother at the hands of the police, and they were clearly out there in riot gear all day long. It's no excuse why that car drove down that street that fast, and it's hundreds of police in the area. No excuse.
So in your opinion, I just feel like this is obvious. What were they doing? And the police, I mean, what, they don't care. And why do you think it happened this way?
So I'm a conspiracy theorist, number one. I'm happy to say that. I think what they thought was, you have a whole bunch of men with guns walking through, right? Because these guys were clearly armed heavily, lock, loaded, and ready. I think they thought guns were going to get into play, and this was going to be a political gain to talk about gun rights and, you know, gun laws. And I mean, I don't know. I feel like it was a bigger issue than what we can all put our hands on, because first off, why are they here with all these guns? If anybody else of any other ethnic group get caught with a gun coming through states, they're going to be charged and they're going to go to jail. So the question arises is, how did you travel all these states with these firearms? Number one. Number two, why were you not protecting the citizens of this town, right? Because at first we got to question how all these firearms are allowed in our city when we clearly have always dealt with violence issues or gun issues in the black community. See, now I'm separating black and white because a lot of black guys are sitting in jail right now for firearm charges, regardless if they got caught with a gun or not. The gun could have been somewhere else. They could have been somewhere else, but they're sitting in jail doing time for it. Then why weren't you given the equal? Here you have a group of men with guns, right? And then you have a group of people with no firearms. Why are you not protecting them?
Yeah, it's mind blowing, really. We're talking with Tanisha Hudson about the events of August 12th. This is 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. We're about 30 seconds from a break, a hard break. So, Nancy, do you want to offer a question before that break?
I do apologize, Ellen, but I could not hear the end of Tanisha's answer for whatever reason. That's why if you were looking for me, I wasn't there.
No, that's okay.
Yes, Tanisha, actually, I would. I was wondering what your impression of this whole notion about being there for the taking down of the statue. Is that how you saw how this rally was came to be, or did you think it was about something else?
So I think everybody throws it on a statue, but it's deeper than a statue at this point. It never was about the statue, no more than it was about the water fountains or the bathrooms during the civil rights movement. The statue is just a pawn that everyone wants to use now that it was over the statue. The reality is that it's over injustices altogether. I think a lot of people are starting to see the injustice that America is dealing to certain people, and it's unfair.
Mm-hmm. So we're going to go to a break. We'll be right back with Tanisha Hudson. Also, we have Grace Hale, professor of American History, American Studies, that is. We'll be right back after we take a quick break. Welcome back. This is 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. We're having a really great discussion, listening really to what Tanisha Hudson has to say. She was at the events, the rally, the alt-right rallies, white supremacy, whatever you want to call it, on August 12th here in Charlottesville. Tanisha, you were addressing what Nancy had asked you about the statue and what it's really about. If you could continue on that vein, along that vein.
Sure. So, as I was saying, you know, it's no more about the statue than it was about the water fountains or the bathrooms during the civil rights movement. You know, we're dealing with a country that feels the law can bend and fold for certain individuals, but it doesn't happen for other individuals. And I'll elaborate just a little bit more about that. Guns in general, as was just discussed, and as I was getting to before, guns are never an issue until an African-American man or African-American group or young guys that grew up together from dirt, until they are carrying those guns. Or let's go back to the Black Panthers. You know, guns aren't an issue until black people feel the need to protect themselves. You know, it's okay for white Americans to do this. It's okay for white Americans to do that. But when people of color, who are allotted the same exact rights, when we do it, we're considered criminals. You know, we're considered, like, we're basically treated as second-class citizens in this country. And the reason why we're treated that way is because I feel that history has been so whitewashed over the years that we have no knowledge of who we are. We learn nothing about the great African Americans. I mean, here we are in 2017, and we just had a movie come out, Hidden Figures, that told the story of Katherine Jackson and the other black women that had a massive role in the first spaceship going up into space. Why are we not learning about that in history books? Why are we not learning about the great educators and the great scholars? They teach us, and they put a projection on the black activists that were resistant. And I think resistance is a key word that supremacy wants to hold on to against the black community, because they want us to learn about resistant leaders. This is a new age. Like, we're not going to resist. We have rights. We carry guns. We can protect ourselves. We should know that there were people that did not choose to be oppressed. We should know that the same eclipse that we experienced on Monday was the same eclipse that woke Nat Turner up, that told him, I'm not going to be oppressed anymore. I'm not going to live this way. It's not right, and I have a right to protect myself. We should learn these things. And no, I'm not saying that it's okay for you to go out here and hurt somebody. But what is okay is that it is okay for you to defend yourself if you feel the need to. You know, everybody turned their backs on Trayvon Martin. The police told the man to stand down, stay in his car. He got out anyway, and he got off with killing a child. You know, these are the injustices that we as African Americans face. And it's not just African Americans at this point anymore. It's more of us. But we have the Hispanic community, and we have the lower poverty level white community that get the bad end of the stick just as well. So it's not about a statue. It's more about control and power. And we feel we're better than you. We feel we're higher than you. We all bleed the same.
Mm-hmm. So, because unfortunately we have limited time, I really want to get to a couple things with you, which one is, I know you're extremely active here. What is going on in Charlottesville with the latest? Like, things are happening every day with memos being leaked and new ordinances with the light of day maybe being shown about what really can happen with that statue, even though it's not about the statue. Just what is going on in Charlottesville? And also, perhaps after that, what do you think we should do? Also, I'm just wondering, you know, is Charlotte, you don't have to answer all of this, but, you know, is Charlottesville really, we're like the beacon here. Are people looking to us? And do you feel that way, that this is, you know, it's always important to do the right thing, but Charlotte, I think people are looking at Charlottesville in a different way, to be the leaders on this front. So pick one of those, Tanisha.
Well, let's just start here. First off, we have people leading Charlottesville that I feel have no interest in Charlottesville, number one. I think they have ulterior motives. That's definitely not for the people of Charlottesville. I think more Charlottesvillians, and I'm saying people that's been here for a long period of time, we have to step up and we have to take our city back. Like, this is our city. We've been here our whole life. We pay our taxes. We lend them powers to work for us. We don't lend them powers to create policies against us. Number one, we have to have policymakers that understand the conditions of the city before we put them in office. And for a long time, Charlottesville has been a popularity contest. It's who can create the most money, who's generating the most money. It's a little blacklist. And if you're a part of that blacklist, 9 times out of 10, you're going to win city council. 9 times out of 10, you're going to become mayor. We have to get away from that. And I think this last election, Orange Hitler, as you called him, he proved that money can buy you anything, even a White House. So, at this point, nationwide and as well as Charlottesville, sometimes you have to destroy before you can elevate and become great. And this may be our destruction period. This may be a period where we are going to actually fall. But falling is not always a bad thing. Sometimes you have to fall to kind of build yourself up stronger. Like, falling down to your lowest point in life helps build that character that you need to become a better you. So I think this fall is going to help us build more character to become a better Charlottesville. But at this point right now in Charlottesville, we are not the capital of resistance. We are not a world-class city, and we are not a happiest city. The city has been fabricated. The story of this city has been fabricated for a long time, and the truth is coming out.
I mean, I've been really angry about that, thinking about all this. You know, just like we're taking the statues down, I feel like I don't want any reference to that anymore. You know, that we're the happiest city, or we're the capital, or all that stuff. We come out, for people who don't know, Charlottesville is continually listed in the top, whatever, 10 of these things that, you know, these lists of really positive things. And I think we should put a stop to that. But go on.
I also think that Charlottesville and UVA, there has to be a line drawn between the two. I mean, it's no secret. The university is buying up everything in the city. It's right behind them, or like letting them do it. And they're not just buying everything in the city. They're in Madison. They're in Horn. I mean, everywhere you go, you see something with UVA. So we should no longer be a tale of two cities. It shouldn't be the university in Charlottesville. It should be Charlottesville. And they have to look out for the people that are not at a certain level. Because you have to remember, it's poor people everywhere. And the poor people have a voice just as well as these big developers and these big businessmen and these, you know, fine corporations that are coming here. The people have a voice, and the people need to be listened to. Because the people are in these meetings. You don't see these big corporations in the meetings. You see the people in the meetings. And the people are not being heard. The people are not being satisfied. The people are not allotted the same protections as the people with money.
I mean, you were at City Council Monday.
Sure was.
Three people got arrested or put in jail, right? I don't see any arrests except for the murderer, any other arrests. So what did you think about that?
Well, if we go back a couple months, Kessler and his crew were doing the same things that those people were doing, talking, doing a meeting, calling West Bellamy a racist in the meeting, you know, basically taking all character and what West Bellamy stood for during the meeting. They weren't thrown out. They weren't arrested. Another older gentleman that represents what Kessler them stands for, he did the same thing. Got up, yelled during the meeting. They didn't get arrested. So again, we're dealing with instances where the mayor wants to pick and choose when he wants to arrest someone, when he wants to work. The police, once again, picking and choosing when they want to work, when they don't want to work. Because these are the same cops that were out there Saturday. Detective or Sergeant O'Donnell, he was out there Saturday doing nothing, actually standing on the funeral home porch all day doing nothing. But then they came in heavily ready, buffed up, ready to work, throwing women on the floor.
You know, Tanisha, you wrote an article a year ago about removing that statue, and you're describing, obviously you already alluded to, all types of cops. I get you have a history, obviously, living there, and I'm wondering, as awful as August 12th and August 11th were, what is your feeling about the future of Charlottesville? Right, you know, if going forward, as you mentioned, like the city council elections, et cetera, how are you feeling about that?
I just feel at this point, until there's accountability, had this city said, we apologized, we dropped the ball, we don't know where we went wrong, we're working on finding those holes, it would have gave the community some type of transparency. The future of this city is definitely going to be transparency. There's too much stuff behind closed doors happening. They're not transparent with the city. They're not transparent with the citizens here that pay taxes. You know, 30 years ago, they knew that they were going to develop the way that they're developing now. I've went back and microfished all kind of Daily Progress articles from the downtown mall all the way back in the early 70s, late 60s. These are things that we knew were going to happen, but nobody paid attention to. Now we have way too many people paying attention to it. So it's no excuse now for things to happen and we not go down there and voice our opinions, or we not go down there and get these petitions together and get people to sign to stop this stuff from happening. So the future of this city is going to be the citizens being a lot more active and less people turning their back to these real issues. Because, again, as you stated, that article was over a year ago. This statue fight has been almost, we're 2 years in on this statue fight. So this is 2 years, and look how many people are just starting to pay attention to these issues and these injustices. And I'm glad the large numbers are coming out, but I feel like if the large numbers would have came out 2 years ago, none of this would have happened. It wouldn't be any blood on the hands of the city.
Mm-hmm. Good point. So I feel sad ending our interview. Nancy, do you have any parting words, and then we'll continue? I just want to give you a chance because I can't see you.
I know that we all need to do, white people definitely, you know, we need to do better. We need to pay more attention. And I am hoping, you know, I am hoping that we push back from our side, because, you know, we have to hold up our side as well. And it's just terrible. And I'm thank you though, Tanisha, for taking time to talk to us. You know, I know it's not done. I get it, you know.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Tanisha Hudson, local activist, born and raised in Charlottesville. I'd love to keep talking to you and have you come back.
Yeah. Thank you guys for having me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, it was great to meet you.
You too.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you. So, hey, Nancy.
Yes, I know. I need to breathe through my my news of note.
And then just to let people know, we're going to speak with Grace Hale in just a moment. She's a professor of history at UVA, and we'll get into some more discussion about race in a minute.
Sure. Yes, it's endless, sadly. My news of note is in Phoenix for two people. First of all, last week for Trump, speaking of Charlottesville, for, as you know, proclaiming himself the biggest victim of Charlottesville, you know, because he was misunderstood by the media when he clearly was lying about his comments. You know, he mentioned himself, I think, like 250 times, never mentioning the 10 U.S. sailors who died on the USS McCain, though, of course, he took a moment to trash the war hero dealing with cancer, and then what he did last night, which was he alluded to on in his rally that he was going to pardon, and he did. He pardoned the ex-sheriff Joseph Aparo, who was facing jail time for civil rights violations for racially profiling minorities and ignoring a court order to stop doing that. He did that anyway. The two of them, he and Trump, are like, are so like-minded. They both think they're above the law, and that's what I find most upsetting about this, that Trump once again steps on the Constitution and applauds this guy, gives him a pardon, disregards what the judiciary was going to even recommend because he knows better. And lastly, about all that, I truly do think this is exactly how he's going to handle whomever Mueller may put a criminal indictment on. He's just going to pardon everyone. He's going to do exactly what he did last night.
Yeah. Okay. So I'm just going to do this. Hold on 1 second while I mess with my dials. That was for you.
Okay.
No, that was for everybody. I just finally found where the sound effects were. So yeah, it's horrible. But with no further ado, we're going to have to take a break very quickly, but we'll continue with Grace Hale. She's a professor of history and American studies at UVA, and she has written a book called Making Whiteness, one of a couple of books. And Grace, welcome back to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Our second timer.
Yes, you're welcome. So I'm just going to let it rip and just say, is there anything that you feel compelled to say after listening to Tanisha? Also, I just want to ask you now or after the break, you know, you're a professor, has any of this stuff, although it's been going on for a long time, are you changing the way you're talking to your students? So you can just choose one of those.
Well, just to add to the powerful commentary of Tanisha, I would say that, you know, one issue that activists have been working on in this town for a very long time that would go a long way to making this a better town is for the university to actually pay a living wage. And I think that's one of the most important issues in the city. And there needs to be pressure put on the university to finally, at long last, achieve that. It would go a long way to changing some of the issues in the city, because the university is, after all, the largest employer. And, you know, the university does a sort of dodge by contracting out to people like Aramark for some of its workers, and then doesn't have to claim those as actual UVA employees, so that it can claim to pay a higher lowest wage than it actually does if you look at the contracted out laborers who are, you know, serving students food and cleaning up food areas all over the university. So not to get too much into the weeds of that, but that is a concrete issue that activists in this town have been calling for years. I've lived here 20 years, and people have been working on this for 20 years, and the university still hasn't done it. So
Thank you. That's a great point. So we're going to go to break. We'll be right back with Grace Hale. Welcome back. This is 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. We are fortunate to have back with us Grace Hale. She is professor of history and American studies at the University of Virginia. And we were just talking about living wage, which has been an issue here for a long time. So thanks for bringing that up. And I also want you to address the question we asked before about how your teaching may be affected by what's been going on, if it has at all, in your classroom?
Well, as somebody who's been here for 20 years teaching the history of the South and the 20th century, and also teaching about race and American society and American culture in my American studies classes, it's not transforming the way I teach. It is sadly making that teaching feel even more, perhaps too relevant. You know, I don't think professors are often go around saying they wish their research was less relevant, but I think that that is the case. I mean, I would have hoped that 20 years into my career teaching at UVA, that these issues would not keep coming up.
Yeah, it is quite incredible. I didn't actually think of it that way, but right, it's you almost don't want to call yourself a historian right now. I mean, it's like present day or something. And what is your feeling about this whole notion that we can't learn our history without statuary?
Well, I actually am one of the people that have thought those statues should come down for a long time. I'm also one of those people that Tanisha was referring to that probably hasn't been active enough on this issue, has not been enough of an activist. But as an intellectual and as a scholar, it's certainly research that I've done in a position that I have taken, and it's. You know, the idea that we can't teach history without these statues is really ludicrous. When I teach my 20th Century South class, I take my 120 UVA students on a walking tour of downtown Charlottesville to teach the Lost Cause. I was really looking forward to teaching that class again next year and not being able to do that, at least being able to go to one park where one of them would have been removed. You know, long ago it seemed to me pretty clear, like, why should I sit here in a lecture hall and teach the Lost Cause when I can just take them downtown and show it to them. I think the idea that we can't know our history without these statues is really ludicrous. And the reason that that's ludicrous is that those statues were put up in the 20th century to support a lie about history, to support white Southerners' myth about their noble past that they used to legitimate their segregationist present. The Constitution guarantees African Americans full civil rights in the aftermath of the Civil War and emancipation. The constitutional amendments and various civil rights acts guarantee those rights. White Southerners created a system of segregation in the late 19th and 20th century that deprived African Americans of those rights, and they created a story, a mythic story, often called the Lost Cause, today often called heritage, but nevertheless a story that is not true about their past to justify their segregationist present. How can we learn history from statues that were put up to support a false interpretation, a lie to start with?
And what was your impression of how the city council handled the rally and even taking down, presumably, the statue?
Well, I thought the city council was actually brave and actually taking on the issue to start with. I mean, it's something that people have periodically called for since I've lived in Charlottesville, and that, as I said, has been 20 years. I mean, I've heard people periodically bring this issue up, but I think Christine Sakos is to be commended for bringing it up again, as she did, and bringing it to city council. And I thought that they were proceeding in the sort of standard ways that governments proceed. They created a commission to investigate it. They listen to the reports, and then they voted to have the statues removed. You know, ideally, perhaps looking back, they would have had a plan to remove them immediately. But you know, I think that's easy for us to say looking back what they should have done. But I don't want to say that they have erred in their attempts to bring these statues down, because I think they were trying to adhere to the democratic process and to the rules of the city.
And the books, the two books that Ellen sort of alluded to a minute ago, Making Whiteness and A Nation of Outsiders, in some ways, how do you feel those books speak to what happened and what is still happening, let's be honest, but what happened that weekend?
Well, I think that my earliest research as a historian about the creation of segregation, and especially the ways that it became a part of Southern and American culture, I wasn't looking so much at the laws, but at the stories and the ways that white Southerners convince themselves and people in other parts of the nation that what they were doing was okay. So stories were really central to that, and I think what's troubling to me is just how powerful those Confederate myths still are. That's really deeply troubling to me. That should be the past by now, and it is actually not the past. And you can say to people raised in Virginia, you know, think about the fact, you know, do you think that Robert E. Lee is a hero? And many white kids at UVA, and these are smart kids, will not have a problem with that. And I don't blame them. This is what they have been taught. They have grown up learning this story of a noble man. And when I say to them, well, think about it a minute, Robert E. Lee is actually a traitor to the nation. He took up arms against the government. They're, some of my students, again, very smart kids, are really shocked by that. And they shouldn't be shocked by that in the 21st century. So sadly, I think that the power of those stories about the past that white Southerners invented about a kind of noble old South, you know, where whites and blacks lived in harmony on the old plantation, and about this kind of mythic noble struggle, the Civil War. I mean, those stories sadly still have a great deal of power. So I think that's some of where my earlier research comes in. Also, I did a lot of research on violence for that book, Making Whiteness. And though we do not have the kinds of lynchings that were not uncommon in the South, into the 20th century, we do certainly have acts of violence and violent intimidation perpetuated by white supremacists, and that part of the story continues to have relevance too, as we saw so tragically in Charlottesville a few weeks ago.
And a lot of what you also write about in terms of describing the South or understanding the South, you approach it by with the arts, you know, with literally painting and photography and music. And I was wondering why does that appeal to you, and what does that gain in terms of what you learn?
Well, the reason that I approached my study that way is because I am a child of the post-civil rights movement. I grew up in Atlanta in a time of integrated schools, and you know, after the battles of the civil rights movement. And yet it seemed to me that even though the laws had been changed, that there were still problems of white supremacy and still issues of racial inequality. And other scholars had really done amazingly excellent work on the politics and the processes of disfranchisement, for example, which we see again coming back up again today with efforts around the country to disfranchise low-income and minority voters that are really just tragic given how much work and the history that we have on that issue. But other scholars had done done work on things like disfranchisement, things like the politics, the political changes, the changes to state constitutions and other laws. And so what I wanted to look at was the sort of part of the story that was not about the law and politics and the government, what the government was doing and what the states were doing, what the federal government was doing. I want to look at the rest of it, what sort of remained after the civil rights movement, what I called the culture of segregation, the things that were outside of that. And that's what really sent me to novels, to Confederate patriotic organizations, studying those organizations like Sons of Confederate Veterans, looking at the popular culture around the ideas of race and of black and white Southern identity that circulate in those areas that are not the law, but the other parts of society.
Can you talk a little bit about music and your study about segregation and how music further segregated the South?
Well, you know, music is a complicated story, and I'll try to do a tiny bit of it justice. But music is a space where there is always a great deal of exchange and of crossing of whatever social and cultural and political boundaries exist, because musicians are by nature, I use this as a metaphor, promiscuous. They'll take anything they like from anywhere they find it. They hear a lick they like, they'll incorporate it. And so there has always been a tremendous amount of musical exchange. And especially as you enter the realm of recorded music in the 1920s, from the 1920s forward, especially as records begin to circulate and costs come down and people have access to recorded music, you don't even have to actually meet or interact with other musicians. So there's always a great deal of exchange across boundaries between musicians. On the other hand, the music industry, and that industry changes over time, has always attempted to create and create boundaries around particular audiences and figure out what to sell those particular audiences. And because the music industry, the recorded music industry in this country, emerged in a kind of peak moment of segregation, that industry emerged in a very segregated way. So even though musicians and even fans might be having interests across these racial boundaries, the music industry itself really created a vision of music, or worked to sell that music to segregated audiences. And thus you have the kind of pulling apart of what is really working class popular music in the South, music making by whites and blacks and all the other groups that are here too, being segmented into genres that the music industry is then selling to audiences. And those genres then become sort of racialized, right? So that country music is for white people, and the blues, rhythm and blues later on, are those genres are for African Americans. So there's sort of a two sides to that story. There's a tremendous amount of mixing, and you don't want to be too utopian about that, because at the same time as there is all this mixing in creative terms, there is this kind of bifurcation and segregation going on in commercial terms. And of course, in much of the 20th century, one of the huge tragedies of all that is that white people made most of the money, even when the creativity and the innovation is coming out of African American musicians.
Is it? I know we're running out of time. Is it fair to say that art maintains the myths as well as breaks them down? Like it's
absolutely
doing both. Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. It's doing both, and you see that when you see debates about music and race. Right? You have still to this day huge debates about popular music and race. Who is allowed to be a hip hop performer? Who is allowed to be a country music star? There are ways in which the music itself, if you listen to it sonically, really, really cuts against and sort of pushes back against any kind of idea that these things can be walled off. But the industry and the ways that people buy and sell and see music, those kinds of structures and processes support segregation and ideas about difference that we might say and sometimes are white supremacists.
Thank you so much. We have been speaking with Grace Hale, professor of history and American studies at UVA. She's written the book Making Whiteness, and she writes about art and culture, race, the South. Is there anything you want to leave us with that you didn't get a chance to say on a quick note?
Well, I guess the thing that I would say is to Charlottesville citizens who want to think of their town as a great place, who still want to have it on the list of happy people, they should actually think about what they can do to make this town better for our low-income residents of color and our white low-income residents.
Thanks. Ellen.
Thank you. Sorry. Just, you know I got so angry about the list thing, but, there are areas of hope, and I do try to bring that in. So thank you for that. Thank you so much for being here again, and let's do it again.
Okay. Thanks for having me.
Okay. You can stick around or leave.
Good to speak with you.
Yeah. So, Nance, how you doing?
In half a second, I will say that my palate cleanser has to do with something that the last time it occurred, you and I were in high school.
Okay,
and
you're done. It's too late.
On Monday, the first solar eclipse of the century.
All right, we really only have, like, oh.
I'm done.
Oh.
See? If you were listening,
I missed
it.
I wasn't listening. It's a problem. Well, thank you so much, Nancy. You and I will talk again on this show. We wanted to thank our sponsor, the Beckham team at Keller Williams Realty. Also, remember that no one has to do everything, but everyone has to do something. These words are becoming clearer every day. Our theme music is by Springtide and 3540 1900. We will see you next week on Apropos of Something. See you, Nance.
Okay.